city shines like a million pieces of glass. Made some mistakes, but you just throw your head back and laugh. Cigarette smoke still on my clothes. What do you think about me now?
Hey friends, welcome to the Recovering Artist Podcast, healing and recovery in the performing arts. My name's Dean Anthony, and it's great to have you with us. You know, the gift of recovery is one that grows with giving. Unless you give it away, we won't keep it. By sharing our recovery, our healing, and most important, our struggles with others, we tend to value that recovery even more. For me, only in my first year of recovery, it's been the most powerful and humbling year of my life. I have much to learn and much to discover, but I'm willing. In the months ahead, we'll have guests from all aspects of the performing arts industry discussing addiction, depression, anxiety, PTSD, sexual assault, food disorders, discrimination, and of course, sobriety. We're not professionals here at the Recovering Artist Podcast, and we are not affiliated or connected with any 12-step organization. We will have counselors and specialists joining us from time to time, but mostly, it's a platform for the performing artist community to truly have a voice. This is the reason for this podcast. You can find us on Facebook at the Recovering Artist Podcast for upcoming guests and ways to find us on your favorite listening platform. You can also leave us a review, ask questions, make suggestions, or just reach out. We'd love to hear from you. Lastly, a word of caution. This podcast may contain mature content, difficult subject matter, and strong language. Listener discretion is advised. The Recovering Artist Podcast is on now. Hey everyone, welcome to episode 9 of the Recovering Artist Podcast. This week I'm shifting a touch off the recovery and addiction structure of this podcast and I needed to have this conversation today. And I think healing is a huge part of it. I decided to call it Finding the Right Path and Where Do We Go From Here. Now, I know this title might sound a little vague, but the hope was to get more people involved and to listen. With the painful and sadly daily reminder of the massive imbalance of race and discrimination in this country, I wanted more guidance. I'm craving more knowledge. I truly want to find the right path, but I don't always know where to go and how to find it. As I sit here today and wait for the jury to decide the verdict in the killing of George Floyd, I have this enabling sense of powerlessness. But am I powerless? No, I'm not. The reality that I'm just one person, or that I can't help anyone learn or change their minds, or I can't stand up, should not even be in my mind or in my vocabulary. So I reached out to my guest today and asked him to lend his incredible voice to help me, to keep me moving forward. I need the guidance. So my guest today is Reginald Smith Jr., or Reggie. He is a powerful man in many, many, many ways. I met him quite a few years ago and I've watched him soar. His voice, and not just the beautiful singer that he is, just speaks. And when he speaks, people listen. Here's a little background about Reggie if you don't know him. In the 2019-20 season, he made his Metropolitan Opera debut as Jim in the amazing production of Porgy and Bess. And that production went on to win a Grammy. Frequently seen at Houston Grand Opera, San Francisco Opera, Lyric Opera Chicago, Dallas Opera, Opera Hong Kong, Atlanta, St. Louis, Cincinnati, Portland, Wolf Trap, and the list goes on. He has massive concert and recital credits, the Dallas Symphony, Indianapolis Chamber Orchestra, Cincinnati Pops, Lexington Philharmonic, Atlanta Symphony, Houston Symphony, and the Tchaikovsky Symphony in Moscow. He's also a favorite here at the Brevard Music Center, both on stage as well as in concert. People just beam when they hear that he's going to be back. He gratefully came back to Brevard in my first season as director of opera here in 2013. He was a guest artist as Falstaff. He was a pure joy. His presence, amazing attitude, filled the room daily. Such an amazing role model. I knew I'd see great things from him, and I know I'll see much, much more. Besides all the honors, awards, gigs, and his talent, he's kind, gracious, loving, funny, a great cook, and he's real. Such great respect for this young man, and I'm eager to learn. So with that, I give you...
Reggie. There he is. Hello, my friend. How are you?
I'm doing well. How are you?
Oh, I'm grateful to have you sitting with me today. And just have to start off by saying I'm so proud of you. I'm so moved. And it's a part of my life that I get to watch people grow, people develop, people change. It is one of the reasons why I love being some form of an educator. But, you know, I knew when I first heard you and saw you that this was going to be your path. And you have taken that path and just are changing the world. And I love that. So thanks for being here today.
Thank you. That's beautiful words and wonderful sentiment.
Oh, I mean it. I truly, truly mean it.
Thank you.
I'm kind of diverting a little bit from my usual, you know, recovery podcast. But, you know, the way I'm looking at this is this topic that we're going to talk about today is just as much a part of recovery and healing as anything. And recovery takes time. You know, recovery mm-hmm. really does take time. And I've shared with you my story, and obviously the people that are listening today should know my story, so I'm not going to get into that. But, you know, I come to you openly today and really new and as completely innocent as I possibly can, because a part of my sobriety, Reggie, is, you know, I felt like I was reborn in a way. Yeah, so I feel new. And all kinds of aspects of life and my emotional sobriety have just really been hit hard. You know, getting rid of the drinking was one thing, but now the emotional sobriety and how to be proactive, how to change, how to set an example, not for pats on the back, but just to set a new example and realize that this is the way that I want to live. So that's why asking you to come on here today, I just had to do it with... You know, the things that are happening in this world that we're reading on a, sadly, on a damn daily basis, that, you know, I'm powerless to some of it, but I can't be powerless. So, you know, we have problems in our country. We have problems in this industry. We need to change. We need to restructure. We need balance. We need honesty. We need healing. Are we even close?
Well, I think given our latest encounters, you know, that we all have been forced to deal with and we all have been forced to face head on, it's actually opened the door for real change. I think before we've all kind of tap danced around it, you know, put a Band-Aid on top of a gushing wound and said it'll be fine. But now, especially during the pandemic, when there's nothing else going on, we have to face things head on.
Right.
And we have to have those uncomfortable conversations. And so I think we are actually at a cusp of real change because we have no other choice. But the question then becomes, how do we change? How do we make that change? What does that look like?
Right.
As an individual, as an art form, as a company, as institutions. So I think... That's where we sort of find ourselves, is people want to make some change. They want to make a difference, but how do we go about doing it? That's sort of the next big conundrum for everyone.
Right. So what I want to hear is, you know, what's the path that you want to see? And what's that? I mean, obviously, look, in my program, there's steps. You know, I'm taking steps to get through my program. And what are the steps that are happening in your belief system for where we need to go, what we need to do?
Yeah, you know, I think that's such an important thing to realize. And I know we talked about it briefly that, as I told you, my grandmother called it the popcorn generation, the microwave generation.
Sure.
Well, we want everything quickly. Everything needs to change right away. And some of these things are going to take a while because these institutional ideas and systems were not built overnight. So it's going to take a little longer for them to come down. I think the first place where we have to start is honesty and openness. We need to have open, honest conversations about how people feel, about how things are perceived, and then not go into attack mode, but just listen.
Listen.
And then likewise,
I was going to jump on that listening aspect of it. Obviously, we have to listen because, again, that popcorn generation, and even before that, you know, the idea of, are you really listening to this sentence that they're saying, or this information, or are you already formulating what you want to say? I mean, that's the big problem.
That's correct.
And then in that, you know, informative information, there's a defensiveness that automatically comes up. You know, and we chatted before this, we started recording today, you know, there are issues that I am sitting in as a 58-year-old white man that doesn't know what to say, doesn't know what to do. Can I listen? Well, hell yeah, I can listen. But what's my proactive aspect of it?
Yeah, and you know, I find it important for both sides to listen because it's not enough for me to be angry.
Right.
I have to realize that still, even though I might not like it, there has to be some allyship. There has to be somebody on the other side. We have to reach all across the lines and make it work together. Mm-hmm. So it just can't be me being angry at you and then not listening to how you perceive it. I had to explain to a colleague once about white privilege. This was fun because they said, I don't understand why people are mad at me. I didn't do anything. You know, it's not my fault that my parents were well off and that they were able to give me things. Why do I feel like now I have to give something to someone else? You know, he was like, I feel bad that they're disadvantaged, but now I feel, you know, I feel like I'm attacked for having a good life.
Right.
And so I had to go through and say, okay, I want you to speak honestly. I want you to be open because I need to know where you're coming from. As educators, you know, you're taught to find the children where they are, meet them there, give them things they can relate to, and then elevate them to where you want them to go. It's the same thing that we all have to do. So if you know, I want you to rant at me and tell me all the things that your grandpa taught you, and because I need to know where you're coming from. Because then I can meet you. You know, we can then have an honest conversation that says, this is a problem. And so with this person, I told them this story. I said, now imagine if you just got finished singing a recital. You did German, French, Italian, some Russian. You performed for an hour and a half. You did this wonderful event. Everybody's cheering you on. And you get on the elevator in your tuxedo. And someone scooches over and grabs their purse and they start looking at you very nervously. They just saw you on stage.
Right.
But yet when you were in the elevator with them, now you're a threat. I said, now, if you were in the elevator with that person, you could say, hey, why are you doing that?
Right.
That's you using your privilege. Because if I said something about it, then all of a sudden it makes me, you know, the bad guy makes me seem like the angry black man. And I said, that's privilege. is that you can say and do things that I can't, and that you can use that on my behalf. If you ask the question, they're not going to look at you as an angry black man.
Right.
They might actually respond to you. And so, you know, here's where we have to find, where are we? What's the real deal? And then how do we combine these thoughts and efforts to make a real difference? It doesn't mean that everybody, all of a sudden, you know, you need to have black artistic directors at every company, even right. though that'd probably be a good idea. But
that's a
step. You know, it's just yeah. saying, what can you do that can help to make things better? And so I think there are a lot of different individual levels, just simple things like that. I think more conversations and more honesty and more openness is a great place to start.
Right.
Then, once we get past the open, honest conversation level, then we say, okay, who are we? Is this something that we really care about? Is this something that becomes a core value for us, for our institution, for our company? Because when it becomes a core value, you don't just look at casting as, I need to cast an Asian soprano.
Right.
You say, I need the best person for this job, whether they're green, white, yellow. We have makeup.
Right.
We have costumes. You know, when it becomes a core thing for you, then you don't settle for tokenism.
Right. There it is.
Right.
There it is. Well,
and that leads us into our next thing.
Well, you know, we get to that structure, and there's so many A, B, C, D, E sections of that word that are just, we don't have enough time to sit in here for 6 hours and keep talking about that. But that's what I see. But going back to what you said about that, you know, that seems like such a little step to take, to be on that elevator and say, hey, what in the world to someone, you know? It's not that difficult to do, Reggie, is it?
Yeah.
I mean, it's not.
No, but it actually takes courage.
Courage, yes. Another huge
aspect to be uncomfortable and then make other people uncomfortable. But yeah. You have to say, right is right and wrong is wrong.
Right. Reggie, do you know the exact definition of courage?
I will let you enlighten us all.
No, it just seemed to be such a word that I just needed to understand. And that courage word has been a part of my work and my own side of it. But, you know, the definition is this simple: the willingness to do the right thing in spite of fear. And, you know, that there's two parts of that: courage, fear. Boom. I mean, unbelievable to just think about that. To, you know, what's the fear? And there's a yeah. ton of fear. There's a ton of fear that's just floating around this. And, you know, man, I'm speechless. I mean, I could just sit here and not say another word the rest of the time and just let you talk. Because I want to be informed the right way. I want to learn. I want to participate.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know, I think that's one of those things that we have to figure out. What are people afraid of?
Right.
What is the fear? And some of it is just built into our psyches from how we were raised. And,
correct.
You know, like, what are you afraid of? Why does it make you uncomfortable? Why does it make you nervous?
Okay, but
and now, I think
I'm going to interrupt you because mm-hmm. I think this is a big part of the topic that I wanted to go through with you because, you know, as I sit here with you and I hear you say, I need you to tell me what your fears are, meaning me, I need to be able to tell you, Reggie, you know, what my fears are. I also need to share with you what my background is. I also absolutely. Need to share with you. Oh, I got to go off on a tangent here you know, I remember so vividly in 1989. Yeah, I know you weren't born yet. Sorry.
I was. Go on.
That's right. You were. Okay. But You know, I vividly remember one of the most powerful things I think I've ever seen in my life, and I'm just tossing this out here, was in the subway. I moved to New York City. Ooh, hello, New York. Wow, big place, craziness. And, you know, I remember being in the subway and seeing all of the billboards. You know, they have them all over the place, ads for this, ads for this. And something caught my eye, and it was this absolutely beautiful, beautiful photo. And it was two arms extended out. All you saw were the arms. You know, and it was a black person's arm and a white person's arm. And they're each holding a black baby and a white baby, but, you know, switched. And all the things said, Reggie, was no one's born a racist. It's taught. Anyway, so I walked by there and went, wow, okay, that's pretty huge. This was 1989. And I went to try to find that ad somewhere when we decided to have this conversation. Well, it's not there. It's not there. So a part of that discussion with you on my behalf, I need to be able to talk to you about where I come from. What was my scenario? And that's difficult. I think that's difficult to do, right? Because the immediate sense of the conversation is going to go to, I'm talking to someone who's oppressed. I probably wasn't, right?
Yeah.
And is this going to even start off being the right conversation? And I don't know what I just said, if that was even the right thing to say.
Well, again, I think there has to be a willingness to be open and to really listen and to not come into something with a preconceived notion or with barriers up or with walls up, to just say, I'm going to be a vessel.
A vessel.
I'm going to listen. I'm going to take in these things and, you know, we're going to work through this together. Because at the end of the day, everybody has something meaningful and beautiful to say and to give into this world. And you can be a twin and go through the same experience and not experience it the same way.
Right.
Right? So everybody's viewpoint is important. And it doesn't matter if you were raised in a mansion or if you were raised in the slums.
Right.
There's going to be something that connects us because we're human. No one cries in Spanish, right? Nobody yawns in Chinese. It just doesn't happen.
Great point.
There's no, you know, you might have some variations of a French laugh, ha, 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 you know, whatever. But there's no way of, you know.
Yes.
Right.
Yeah.
You know, so there are more things that, you know, no one smiles in Russian. It just doesn't happen. We are humans and it connects us all. So right. Where do we find that human element? How do we connect as one?
Right.
And then, you know, this goes into a little bit to go towards the professional world.
Right.
When you think about telling these stories, what is the truth of the story? What is the honesty? What does it boil down to? You know, who even knows what a Hungarian countess is anymore? Come on, let's get serious. But yeah. What are we trying to say about this relationship and this couple? And how can we make it as human as possible?
Right.
Where anybody can understand what's going on.
But that's the humanity of it, that, you know, there is no separation of humanity. Okay? It doesn't have a color. Right?
Correct.
So when I watched that video clip that came out about Jesse Norman talking about the four last songs, and you, absolutely. If you watch that clip and you watch her sit there and tell that story about that concertmaster playing his last concert, coming into the room and saying, can I play this for you? Because I want it to be right. Bro, I got so choked up because, no. I mean, the humanity of that that connection between the two of them and how moved she was, that he came in, he'd been playing there for 40 years. But then how his humanity, I want this to be right for you. Okay, there's no barriers inside of this except humanity and art. And then yes. when they played that recording of her listening to that, man, I'm sitting here getting choked up just talking about it.
Yeah.
You all need to go watch that and be quiet and listen. Listen to this. This is an incredible artist talking to an incredible artist. And their age gap must have been pretty tremendous, right, Reggie?
Yeah, absolutely.
Now,
but I get emotional thinking about it. You know, I was a mess watching that video.
So was I. And so it starts from there. Okay. So there is no barriers inside of that connection to what you're watching, what you're hearing, But yet we've got barriers.
That is true. Yeah. But you know, that amount of selflessness requires so much courage.
Courage.
And requires that's it. Because to really strip away all the stuff and all the gunk, it's going to be hard. But you know, it's like a diamond. You know, you got to be pressed. You got to go through. You know, it's like iron. You got to go through the fire.
Right.
All of these metaphors, you know, walking through the valley of the shadow of death, whichever way you want to think of it.
Sure.
In order to get to the next level, to where we want to be in life and whatever, you're going to have to let go of some things.
Right.
And you're going to have to go through some things in order to get to that next level. But once you do that, man, is it worth it? You have that greater appreciation. You have a greater understanding. But it's never easy.
Right.
In order to push through to that next level, you got to leave some stuff behind. Right. So it's one thing for me to say, I want my company to be equitable and I want to see more Black, brown, Hispanic, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But then you say, are you willing to risk A, B, and C? And if you aren't willing to do it, then you have to go back and rethink, wow, am I willing to give up some ideas and notions and things that I was raised with that I perceive to be correct in order to do what's actually right? And sometimes the answer is no. Sometimes people think the answer is yes.
Mm.
Until they actually have to bite the bullet and it gets hard.
So, Annalie, what you're saying is that, you know, the problem starts in the industry. Where does the problem start, in your opinion?
I think the problem starts from within.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of times it starts at the top.
Right.
Because think of the 80s, good old trickle down.
One second. But inside of that top does not just necessarily mean the person who's the head of the company.
Yeah, we're talking, there it is.
Okay. We're talking about that group of people that person answers to, right?
That's right.
The board.
That's right. The board, the executive committee, whomever your top folk might be, you know.
Right.
It has to be, this is why I was saying, it has to be a core value of the company. It's one thing to say, we support this. It's another when you actually put your money and your actions towards it.
Right.
And you can always tell what a company actually believes in and what they actually support by looking at the product and the output.
Right.
If they put all their money into huge grand productions and big orchestra and all of that, then that's what they, hey, we're a big grand thing.
Right.
If you say, we're doing all of this, but we put a lot of money into outreach, we put a lot of money into development, then hey, you're about developing as well as trying to, you know, maintain this stand. If they put all of their money in the new works, they're about, you know.
Sure.
You don't have to always read the mission statement to see what people
right. So we're talking about education, which, you know, 90% of this topic is an element of education across the board. Right. Correct. So, but inside of your education structure, are you attending to these problems? Are you looking Correct. To make a difference? And, Correct. You know, and that stems back into that word of which you said tokenism, which is, are we going to do what they might think is a Band-Aid? Let's do something for some, you know, to let people know that we're in this, we're going this direction, but it isn't a systemic change. It isn't, it can be, I'm not saying that, mm-hmm. but mm-hmm. it doesn't take much, it doesn't take long for us now to go, oh, okay, right?
Yeah.
That's just a Band-Aid. Or that's just yeah. one, that's just for this, you know, and I think that that's another part of this pandemic you're talking about is that people are so much more aware because they're watching and they're listening.
Yes.
And they're, I hate to use the word judging, Reggie.
Well, but Mom. They have nothing else to do.
Exactly. You know? Exactly.
And they right. see who's at the forefront of an issue. And they see who's behind on responses.
Right.
And whether they come back and report it to the company or not is one thing. Mm. But it does not mean that they aren't paying attention.
Right.
You know, right. I think about when you talk about education, and here's an example of how do we make things better, right? So people always say, where are these voices? Where are the big voices? Where are the Verdian voices, the rich round voices? And then you go to insert any historical black college university and you go and hear these voices that are like, oh my God, this is amazing. But maybe they don't have as many opportunities
right.
for training in terms of diction and so on and so forth. And a lot of times these kids and these voices kind of get lost by the wayside, or they go to a master's program and they feel inadequate or so. And so you have these summer programs, say mm-hmm. the Reggie Smith Institute. And at the Reggie Smith Institute, I have four voice teachers, and they're all four white men that come from predominant PWIs, predominant white institutions.
Right.
And then they bring the majority of their students.
Right.
And then they attract other students that kind of look like them. And now I have 45 kids at this program. Of that are all white, maybe like two black kids, you know, and then they're like, well, there must not be any black singers. Huh. And we've done auditions at
right.
the institutions where these teachers teach.
Right.
We've not reached out to any of these schools or programs that are nearby.
Right.
And yet we're like, well, the kids just must not be interested.
Right.
They must not be out there.
It's so fascinating.
And it's you know, one of those simple things where even if I'm doing an audition at say, you know, Reggieville University, and there's Reggieville A&M down the street.
Right.
And, you know, why don't I at least send a flyer down to Reggieville A&M and say, hey, we're doing auditions exactly. up the road. Send your kids.
You know, I think it's
something that simple.
You know, it's
or maybe even get the teacher down from Reggieville A&M that's turning out all these voices.
Right. Because
then they see a black person on faculty. You start to get more black kids. You get more people from outside. They go, ooh, a black teacher. Ta-da.
But you know what's fascinating about this is that, you know, this summer at Brevard, I got Sidney Outlaw coming. And, you know, and he's been engaged for a long time. He was supposed to come last year.
Yeah.
And so he's great. Is it before or during or, you know, all the above of all this scenario? No, it's not. I mean, the beauty for me is that this little nook of North Carolina is where he's from, and his
yeah.
mom is still here, and he's got family. And you know, so and he's an incredible artist. Okay, let's just start there. Mm-hmm. And he's teaching, and he's an educator. And these are all the things I'm thinking about. So, well, that's a perfect fit, you know. But then yeah. there's this side of me, Reggie. Here it is. I'm going to be new and completely honest. Is yep. that is someone going to look at me and goes, oh, he is making that choice solely based on the color of his skin? I hope to God not. Does that make sense?
Oh, absolutely. And then what do? You throw out the resume and you throw out the receipts. Because then you say, okay, say I'm making it based on the color of his skin. Right. Let's take skin color out of it. How about the times when you won the Met? What about the recitals here? Exactly. What about the gigs he's done here? What about the things here? Who you got? And you just have to confront those people head on and say, and if I am hiring them because I'm black, is that a bad thing?
That's a good one. Right.
Are you not hiring them because they're black?
Right. You know, the fascinating thing too about, you know, Brevard, for example, is that, you know, I recruit? Yeah, I recruit in my own way. But it's a pretty open-ended look. If you have a year of college, you can apply here, you know, and, and the audition process this year for millions of companies has been video and scary and odd. And we've gone through a couple of the different choices of what we're going to do. But, you know, the thing is that in my choices of people who applied, Reggie, you know, it was a very small number compared to most years. And I understand that. And, you know, and I was aware all the way through the process. And that awareness is good. But it all comes back to this idea of trust. You know, what's the balance of trust in a white person's agenda, if I hate to use the word agenda, or white person's choices based on how the black community thinks about that choice. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I get that. It's
again, now, did I cross a line here?
No. With me, it's hard to cross a line with me. I'm always like, you know, I can always find a way back over if I feel like it's crossed anyway. But no, you're fine. Again, the key is, what are your honest intentions, right? And people can tell if you are being honest and if you are doing something because it's good and because it's right. And people can tell if you're just trying to appeal to people for a certain reason, right? And to appease a crowd for something. And I think as long as you do whatever you are doing with true honesty and with the real good intention in your heart, nobody's going to question it. And if they do, that's their problem.
Exactly.
That's not your problem.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because you know in your heart of hearts that you are doing what's right and have always done so. Right. You know, I'm not the first black person that went to Brevard, you know.
No.
And I'm certainly not the last, you know. And so, you know, it's not like now all of a sudden, oh, I guess we should start accepting black people. Like, no. It's
no. But again, so, you know, I think
honest heart.
But it's, what's so fascinating is that inside this conversation, and we're just talking about this, and what is my head going to? It's going to the beauty of your singing, the just stentorian sound and of what you do. And then I listen to Sydney, and I listen to, you know, I mean, Morris, and Kenny and Karen Slack, and I listen to these voices, and Nicole. I mean, it's incredible, the talent, the talent that, you know, and I just, it's just blows me away. And on top of that, if I want to use you as an example, okay, you are just the salt of the earth. And you're fun, you're joyous, you're giving, you'll pretty much do what you're asked to do in a rehearsal. You come with a bag of tools to put it there. There should be no questions. There shouldn't be any questions at all. I don't know. I just went off on a tangent, but
thank you for that. You hear that, people listening? Yeah. No, but you know, and let me also say that I am not one that says every role should be filled by a black person just because. Look, there's some stuff that's hard, and shoot, I don't want to sing it. You know, and also there are some people, I mean, Juwan Kong, goodness gracious, he right. can sing anything, but like he, Norman Garrett, I love Norman Garrett's sure. voice, right? Will Liverman. And then you have people, you know, like the Joe Latanzis. I mean, if you got it and you can do it, amen and more power to you is what I say.
But you know, but
I'm not saying that you should, my thing is you should cast the person who you think is going to be best for the job. The problem that I have is when you don't cast people because of X, Y, right. and Z.
No, exactly.
I have no problem. If I get beat out for a job and it's like Juwan, I'm like, yeah, I mean, I'd pick him too. Right.
But, you know, again, because of us being available more to watch and to listen, you know, and I see a recording of Will Liverman the other day singing, sitting at the piano singing something. What the heck was it? I listen to everything he puts out because, you know, he's also a Brevard alum. You know, he came here, you know, it was the first thing he'd ever done. He was a baby. And, you know, did I see that talent then? Absolutely. You know, and so, but to sit down at the piano and sing something that's completely outside of the operatic world, I just look at that as a talent. That is a freaking talent that, you know, and I'm so joyous to watch him go through this, what he's doing. And he's also incredible at giving back. And so are you. And so you're out there wanting to do that, you know, and I mean, Kenny Overton, you know, I sang with him back in the day when he was really, really young. And, you know, and I was probably a pain in the ass back then. Well, actually I was, but you know, you know, and I saw him strive and work and not give up and to watch where he is going now and where he's going to go and listen to him. He sounds pretty good. I think you're going to be in New Orleans with him, aren't you, next week?
Mm-hmm. That's right. Next week.
You know, man, that's amazing. Oh my God, I got off tangent here, but
no, it's okay. But it all sort of goes back to a sense of doing the right thing because it is the right thing, and sometimes it means making an unpopular choice and decision amongst your crowd and constituents.
Right.
Sometimes it means going against what people know or what people say is right. But, you know, if we didn't, if people didn't have the courage to do that, we wouldn't have Leontine Price. Mm. We wouldn't have, you know, Martina Arroyo or any of these, you know, Simon Estes or George Shirley, whose birthday is today.
Oh, right. Happy birthday.
You know, but someone had to make the decision that I am going to be the change that I want to see. Mm. And, you know, there's a great, I've had the wonderful opportunity to talk to Simon Estes. Mm. And this is how you can use your allyship. That way you don't have to call it white privilege. But in this case, with Simon Estes, he was singing in Zurich. And there were two other young bass baritones that were trying to get into the ensemble, were trying to get into that program. Mm-hmm. And they wanted him to sing, it was either Flying Dutchman or Votan or something. And he said, okay. And then they said, well, we really want you to do Porgy. Mm. And he said, I don't know about that. And so at the same time, he heard about these two young men that were extraordinary, but they didn't want to take them into the program, mostly because they were black, right? Wow. They were like, we already have one. No thanks. And so he said, well, if you want me to sing Dutchman or, you know, Votan, and you want me to do Porgy, you have to take these two men into the studio.
Wow.
Into the ensemble. And they said, absolutely not. He said, fine. Well, then I'll go somewhere else.
Wow.
And that kind of went on for about a week or so. And then finally they were like, okay, all right, I guess we'll take them into, and they went on to have both of them have fantastic careers.
Right.
But it was because Mr. Estes put his foot down and said, no, I will force you to do what is right.
Good for
you. Or you won't have me. And that takes a lot of cojones, you know?
Yeah, but that just stems right back to that conversation in the elevator.
Yeah, right? Absolutely.
That stems back, and that's where it's not someone else just jumping in. That's boom, there it is. And yeah. I'm sure he handled it with grace and with respect. And from that, what happens? He did the gig, it worked out, and he gave opportunities to other people. That's incredible. That's right. It's an incredible story. That's
right. And so, you know, it's just, I think it just takes one, you know, and then from there, from that seed, then it can be watered, then, you know, planted and watered, and then things start to sprout and things start to grow. But I think it takes that courage. It takes that forethought. It takes that here in your heart that says, this is the right thing and I'm going to do it regardless. And we see that throughout history, not only in terms of Black history, but also what is American history in general. We've seen people like Eleanor Roosevelt, you know, Susan B. Anthony, and whatever you want to say about whatever women's suffrage. But at some point, somebody has to make a decision. As Fannie Lou Hamer said, I'm sick and tired of being sick and tired.
Right.
And so we have to make some sort of choices. Now, when it goes back to, you know, we kind of also think about that in the education world, right? Like, how are we growing this mindset, this idea? You know, I think about classes like African American art song literature, and I'm like, they're American art songs,
right?
Why is there a difference between John Musto and Leslie Adams,
right?
You know, things like that.
So what you're already doing is separating it
already. Boom. You know, we talked about what is American opera, and the whole time people were talking about Copeland, and they were talking about Bernstein, and I said, what about Tree Manisha?
Right.
Is Scott Joplin not an American?
Right.
You know, what about these operas that, you know, by these Black people? What about the William Grant Steele works?
Yeah. No, but that leads me to, I'm not going to change the subject.
Go ahead. I want you to pivot to wherever you want to go.
I'm going to pivot it to that discussion that, you know, about projects. Okay.
Yes.
About projects, and the fact that how do we? Okay. How does a white man attempt to develop a project that is about a story that might be considered oppression again? And I know that. Which is difficult, but a project that seems like on paper, this could be a really cool project. And, you know, I have one, you know, and your former voice teacher, Dr. McCorvey, is interested in that. And I have this idea that's been stewing for a couple of years, Reggie. You know, I even spoke to Kenny about it. I spoke, you know, and I'm sitting on it and I'm being really, really cautious. You know, because I don't know what my role is in it.
Yeah.
So I'm sitting on something. And so what do you do with that? Is that weak? Is that what? What do I do? Where do I go?
Well, I think you have to, again, what is the human element of the story? What is the core? What is the thing that we all can grasp from this?
Right.
That's the first place to start in your mind, and then say, from that lesson, we cover it, or we tell the story of that lesson through this lens.
I get it.
Right. And then once you get to that point, you say, now how can I make sure that I'm not offending anyone? Okay. Let me find people that understand this a little better than I do.
Of course.
Right. And then we can work together and say, this is my thought and this is my vision. is right. this offensive or is it not? And you have to find somebody that you trust and that is open and honest. And you know, maybe you work with someone as a librettist or a co-librettist, or you can just produce it, or,
well, right,
or say that, it was conceived by.
right. That's my famous, you know, that's what my famous word is, you know. But I think you're right. I brought this up just because it is past that point of just conception. And and I think the reality is that I have to be sober enough, as well as is open enough and trustworthy enough to say, yeah. Hey, if this is something that works, I need to be willing to pass it off.
Yeah.
And step
or at least finding,
well, yeah,
finding the right team, exactly. Right? You know, like, yeah. Like, DeBose Hayward, you know, and Ira Gershwin right. really worked together to curate what then became the libretto for Porgy and Bess right. based on, Hayward's sort of thoughts. Right. And then, you know, maybe it's finding a black composer or a black librettist or whatever,
there's no question.
Somehow to right. where there's, you know, there's this thought, there's a union that moves things forward. Now, I will say, to slightly pivot about this, it's so interesting. We talk about these projects, and it's so important for us to see and experience these black stories, these American stories, these human stories through these lenses, much the same way we do with a show like Fellow Travelers.
Right.
You know, it might be the fact that there's two men that are in love, but yet you see what happens when one person loves another one and they can't quite return that love.
Mm.
And what does that look like? What does that feel like? I think enough people have gone through that.
Of course.
That didn't matter if you said it was two anteaters falling in love. You'd still, you know. Right. I don't know why I thought of an anteater, but there you go. But you know, it's that. So I think the next step also is we have to get all these stories out. But I think it's also important to show the other elements of Black lives, Black culture, Black experience, that's not always traumatic. Right. I think there's always a, I don't know, people love seeing Black trauma, but Black happiness somehow seems to be a problem. Like, I don't understand. And it doesn't necessarily mean that you have to come up with some new Black comedy, because there's always going to be a crux, right?
There's always
gonna,
Reggie, because conflict... Is conflict is different than tragedy. Yep.
That is correct.
And the reality is that, you know, comedy is usually much more difficult to conceptualize because it just is, you know, or it turns out to be a, you know, a stand-up comedian, turn a comedy into an opera that doesn't work.
That's why there are less comedies in general in the operatic canon.
Name me one comedy that doesn't have some through line thread of conflict. You know, it's not worth telling. It's not, you know what I mean? Right.
Oh, absolutely.
So we need to look at other ways to do these stories and tell these stories. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and I think minds are working. I think things are starting to come out and people are taking these risks and, you know, seeing all these different people making choices of creating new work. I'm stoked about it, you know?
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, go ahead.
No, I was going to say, I think it's always so that you talk about want to be bold and, you know, really put people on their toes. You could take some of these things that are in the typical canon,
right,
and change the casting around and then see, oh, what does that look like? Mm. In a you know, for instance, if you have Peter Grimes, if you really want to be avant-garde and push the button, have an all white cast and then a black Peter Grimes.
Interesting.
What does that look like? How do people perceive that? You know? Or same, you have a black Olin Blitch in Susanna.
Right.
What does that look like?
Mm-hmm.
Now that kind of changes things a little bit in terms of how people perceive the story. I thought it was so interesting. A couple of years back at Kentucky Opera, they did Three Decembers with Denise Graves. Okay. It was Denise, Carlton Ford, and unfortunately, I can't remember the soprano. But it's about, you know, Three Decembers.
Sure. Yep, absolutely.
And, you know, it's about the mother who's the superstar and, right. you know. And they didn't make any big, you know, they didn't make a big fuss about it being an all-black cast and all that.
Okay.
But it changed how people saw the story.
Of course.
Yep. With, you know, the black superstar mom that's just, sure. you know, it just changed how people received the story. And so I find those things kind of interesting. And how do you do that while still being true to the work? While,
exactly.
You know, but while also giving it a little salt.
Right, but I love the idea that solely based on me as a viewer of, you know, conceptualizing that and putting, well, it's one thing we do. I mean, based on the time period,
Reggie? That's correct.
As a time period, then what you're automatically doing is you're putting your brain into their timeline and into and what was going on around them. You know, what was the pressures of life? And, you know, and I would look, I'm a director. I'm a, you know, whatever. I try to be a storyteller. So I'm looking at a show completely different than XYZ other person, you know. And I don't sit around my little shack here and say, ooh, I got to tell a story. Ooh, I got to tell a story. What can I think of? What can I think of? You know, so that's just not who I am. If something comes in my brain, I think about it and we start to, you know, and so that's a really cool thing.
But I think, you know, even there was a production of Bohème that I heard about. I didn't get to see it, where they set it in New Orleans, you know, and so it was still Christmas, you know, because New Orleans at Christmas time is pretty.
Right.
But, you know, they have like Bourbon Street and they're all, you know, act
two. But they just didn't have to wear wool coats, right? Because it was in New Orleans.
That's right. But you still have, you know, this big party scene.
Right.
But then, you know, down the road, it's not so much party anymore, right?
Right.
They live real lives and they have to deal with the realities of sometimes poverty and, you know. So anyway, but when you sort of take things away from, this is, you know, the director brain, right?
Sure.
Sometimes when you divorce, you know, Café Momus in Paris from, you know, people's brains, then they say, wow, this is different. This is, you know, I perceived it in a different way. Then you can start to cast things probably a little more differently.
Right.
Because when you say it's New Orleans, you're like, well, there has to be black people. Right. At least somebody, Parpignol, something. Parpignol. You know, or otherwise it's not New Orleans.
Right, right.
But you know what I mean? It's just having that, taking those risks, being willing to do something different, being willing with whatever you have, whether it's you as a performer, whether it's you as an educator, as someone who runs a company, as someone who is a director, who's a conductor, who's casting things, being willing to be one, a real artist, but also someone who is truly human and that understands that what we do is so vital for humanity in terms of telling these stories, but also in healing. What we do through music and through the arts is so underrated, I feel, and underappreciated because, you know, just like you were saying that video with Miss Norman, there were no words, you know, when that played. Da, 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 dee, da, da, dee. And I was just gone, you know?
Yes. And that emotional core of love and hope and all these things is innate inside of you as a person.
Yes. And you have to be willing to go to that place. And again, sometimes to get to that place, you have to shed some of those things that are comfortable for you, right, that are familiar, in order to get to that core,
right,
and say, this is who I am. This is, you know, this is what's right. This is what's important.
Yeah. So what you just said, which triggered my brain to go, so, you know, working from the core outward is better than working outwards and trying to get into the core.
That is exactly right.
Does that make sense? That makes sense. And then the hope of this healing and this growth and this willingness and the listening will slowly or turn into trust. And how that trust, it's not going to happen for everybody. We know that, right?
Yeah,
right. It's just not. And I think that's the hardest thing. That's life. Well, it is. But I also, you know, every new episode that we see on the news, just, you know, it's, you take some steps forward, then you get kicked in the teeth again. And then you try to step forward and get kicked in the teeth again. And then it's just the imbalance of where our country and the world, for that matter, is, you know, I think some people just say, whatever, you know what I mean? Whatever. Yeah. It's out of my hands. I can't do anything. Well, I think we can, Reggie. I think we can do something. And it's not just a freaking post on Facebook. Okay. Absolutely. It's just not, you know, you know, I don't mean to bash Facebook, but, you know.
No. But it just, yeah, it's like we have to remain vigilant in what we do in terms of reaching out and saying, we're here, this is what we want, you know. But at the same time, we have to have someone reaching from within that says, I understand. So then eventually our hands can meet, our goals can meet, and then we can come together and create a real change. But it won't do any good if I'm saying, here, I'm trying to help you. I'm trying to help you. I'm trying to help you. And no one's on the inside is trying to do the same thing. And, you know, this is where we talk about tokenism. Mm. This is where we talk about having a seat at the table. And what does that look like? It doesn't mean if you have one black person on your board and there's 25 people.
Right.
And only that one person really cares about this change. You're still going to be, you know, voted out, you know,
or that dreaded sentence that I know you've heard, which is, let me think about that.
Which means I'm not going to think about that.
Sadly, 9 times out of 10, Reggie, it does mean that. And that is, I've learned that over this past year about that phrase. Let me think about that. It's basically just a way for you just to tap dance around. I thought about it, or I'm going to let you know I'm thinking about it, but I'm not going to do anything about it.
That's right.
So honestly, that word is gone from my vocabulary now.
Yeah. It's like, how do we, even if it's small steps,
right,
you know, we have to keep moving forward. We have to keep trying, you know, and in our own way and in what we do. So an example, I'm doing a recital coming up. And as I said, you know, we become so accustomed to black trauma that we sometimes forget that black people can do other things. And so instead of a recital of African-American literature that's surrounded by slavery or black history, you know, which is great. I love it. I love all of those things. But I decided to do a recital of African-American songs or song literature with texts that's not in English.
Oh.
To show, and a lot of it is based around love.
Cool.
Whether it's love lost or wanting love or growing. But I have songs in German, French, Italian, Creole, Mandarin, Yoruba, you know, language of Nigeria. I mean, because why not?
Right.
And to show that, wow, there's so much out there. There's so much that we can do. And so it's just my one little contribution that says, I'm going to show that we can do more and that we can be more and that this music is valid and should be taken seriously.
But how much joy did that bring you to research that repertoire and to find this repertoire?
Oh, man, it's amazing because there are certain things that I, you know, I sort of had my pillars in mind, right?
Right.
I'm going to do this. I'm going to do that. Oh, let me see what's over here. And pieces by like the young warrior, Jordi Guerriero by Burley, Harry T. Burley, who most people know for like Deep River and all right. of that. James Weldon Johnson, you might know that name from mm-hmm. Lift Every Voice and Sing,
right.
did the original text in English. Well, the piece was then translated into Italian.
Wow.
And was used as sort of an Italian call to arms song for war. So most wow. people don't know it here. But if you're of a certain generation in Italy, you're like, oh, yeah, that yeah. song that was written by a black man that was used all over Italy. You know? Boom.
Time to learn. You know,
things like that. You're like, wow. You right. know?
Very cool.
So I've had a great time researching this repertoire and learning it and right. really trying to share and show a different side of myself as an mm-hmm. artist. Sure. But a different side of African-American compositions and contributions to Western art song literature. And, you know, what I feel and what I hope happens is I'll do these songs. I'll put them up, you know, like a Facebook Live video. Right. And someone goes, wow, I didn't know that song. And they write it down. Mm. And then they go, well, I should do this on my recital.
Boom.
And then somebody hears that on their Education. Recital. And next thing you know, everybody wants to do, you know, Nye Rien by yeah. Gary Powell Nash because they want to sing in Mandarin.
Right.
You know, so
that's the part of teaching. It's just, that's an element of you, but that's an element of you that I have great respect for because you are a teacher at heart. Through your compassion, through your grace, and through your unbelievably hard work. Let's not put that aside. And there is this, there is, to me, I believe, there is a healing quality about you. I mean, you're not without piss and vinegar. Let's just say that.
The Lord knows that's the truth.
But I love that. But there is an essence. Look, I mean, you decided to sit on this thing with me today and sit with me, which is huge for me. And it means the world to me. And I think you already know that, Reggie. Yeah. But I think we need to wind things down here. But is there anything else that off the top of your head you can think about by just putting the word healing or recovery into this topic that we haven't already said?
Well, I think the biggest thing is to remember, as a great philosopher and prophet said, you know, you have to love your neighbor as you love yourself.
Right.
And RuPaul went on to say, if you don't love somebody, yeah, you're going to love somebody else. Can I get an amen? But the, you know, right. to quote both Jesus and RuPaul in the same sentence, you better know it. But yeah. it goes back to the same thing of loving your neighbor as yourself. But then the question is, do you love yourself?
There it is.
What does that look like? What does that, and then put yourself in that person's shoes. Right. Say it was your son. Say it was, you know, what if it was your concert? Mm-hmm. This is what I was saying earlier with a person where I had to explain privilege to them.
Right.
I said, now imagine how you would feel. You just did this entire concert and someone says, wow, you're so well spoken. Well, I right. hope so. I went to school and got multiple degrees. But, you know, I can't say that because then now, you know, it's right. And so it's a matter of being selfless more than selfish, right? Thinking about yourself less, literally, and putting yourself in the other person's shoes and saying, do I think that's right? Do I think it's fair? And then going back to your shoes and saying, okay, now what can I do to help in that situation? No one's asking you to be Rosa Parks and sit on the bus and, you know, but simple things like addressing an issue. You know, I saw the way that, you know, this went down with The Soprano. Is there any way we can deal with that? Or I saw a video recently of a person being detained by an officer, and it was a person that was walking their dog, and they just stopped and stood there the whole time until, you know, they said, oh, I'm just standing here walking with my dog. The police can't make you leave.
Right.
And they just wanted to make sure that the person was okay until the police officer left.
Wow.
You know, little things, loving your neighbor as you love yourself, but then you have to put yourself in those shoes and say, right. would I be okay if this were me? Right. And then what can I do? And so the more we can do that in our own individual lives, the more it starts to show up in our professional lives, in our community, right. in our arts, and in our world, because it becomes ingrained in who we are to do the right thing in spite of.
Right.
To do the right thing because of. And that's the goal.
Well, you know, I mean, in the word I process in that is getting out of self, which is a huge part of my journey. Getting rid of the ego, getting rid of judgment, use the word assessing versus judging, but also just service, right? Yeah. Just service. And the idea of if this conversation helps someone, or if it opens one's eyes or whatever it does, it certainly has opened my eyes. And, you know, whether or not, Reggie, we're sitting at the table together, you know, I don't think that that's even what this is. I think this is just us talking and listening and putting it out there. And, man, I'm moved. You are a very smart young man and incredibly talented and funny. We all know Reggie.
Oh, well, thank you.
And,
You'll appreciate this. I was working on a show where I was playing one of many a villain, as I often do. And the rehearsal process was very intense and so on. And, you know, it was afterwards that we were doing something and the director heard me laughing with someone. And he said, wow, you're actually pretty funny. I said, well, I try to be. And he said, well, I would have never known that from rehearsals. I said, yeah, because it's not funny when you're running around trying to stab people. Nice. My character is not very like, hey, everybody, stamp, exactly. You know, like, but, you know, I would say the other part of it is knocking down that perception, being okay with people are going to say things.
Mm.
People are going to question. People are going to say he's doing this just because, and letting go of all the chatter and all the clutter and being true to yourself and being true to your heart and your mission and say, I know who I am. Right. I know why I'm doing this. This is the right thing, whether they like it or not. This is the right thing, whether they question me about it or not.
Right.
And that takes the word that we used, courage.
Right. Because, I mean, in that definition of courage, whatever fears I had about this conversation, you were open to let me say whatever I said and ask the questions, which is what has to happen. You know, it really does, because I don't know it all. I don't know squat, you know, but if I'm not able to communicate with you that this is what's my brain is going to this first, you know, and maybe the people want me to get that part of my brain out. But if I can't get it out, then I can't discuss it and get to a resolution for that to say, okay, this way of thinking is not going to do me any service. And it's not going to help me service others. Right. Get over it, Dean. You know, figure it out. You know, pray on it. Do whatever you need to do. Mm-hmm. So that's why I loved having this conversation with you. So,
well, thank you. I'm glad you had me on.
Oh, my gosh.
It's always great to have conversations with you and chat. And,
well, you know, I appreciate you.
And figure out the world's problems. I'm just kidding.
We just fixed them all, didn't we, Reggie?
That's it.
It's all good. Well, look, my friend, I appreciate you, and I wish you a blessed day. And I just can't thank you enough. And I know that those who are going to listen are going to benefit from hearing your wisdom. Yeah.
Thank you.
All right, my brother. You take care. And have a great time down in New Orleans. And
absolutely.
And I'll come out of retirement if you ever need that cop character. You know what I mean? Yeah. I always just wanted to do that, just to be with you guys, you know?
And, you should. And
hear that art and hear that beautiful work and that beautiful piece. So
man,
I'm proud of you, young man. I am very, very proud of you and honored to know you and humbled to know
you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, Reggie. I appreciate you.
I'd like to end my time with you today with a reading from my friend, mezzo-soprano Jamie Sharp. A vibrant young presence in this world and someone who is, and I know will continue to make a difference. Besides being a talented singer, she's the CEO of Opera Next Gen, an organization that will provide operatic performances with a diverse artistic community. Founded on equity, equality, inclusivity, and excellence. I love this quote from Opera Next Gen's mission statement. It is our aim to cast solely on vocal ability above all other credentials. Hear, hear. Thanks for sharing with us today, Jamie.
Colorblind by Lem Sisse. If you can see the sepia in the sun, shades of gray in fading streets, the radiating bloodshot in a child's eyes, the dark stains on her linen sheets. If you can see oil separate on water, the turquoise of leaves on trees, the reddened flush of your lover's cheeks, the violet peace of calm seas. If you can see the bluest eye, the purple in petals of the rose, the blue anger, the venom of the volcano, the creeping orange of the lava flows. If you can see the red dust of the famished road, the white airtight strike of Nike sign, the skin tone of a Lucian Freud, the colors of his frozen subjects in mine. If you can see the white mist of the oasis, the red, white, and blue that you defended, if you can see it all through the blackest pupil, the color stretching the rainbow suspended, if you can see the breached blue dusk and the caramel curls in the swirls of tea, then why do you say you are colorblind? When you see me.
Thanks for joining us here at the Recovering Artist Podcast. We'd love for you to keep listening down the road. A special thanks to my amazing nephew, Tyler Anthony, for our theme song, What Do You Think? Written by Tyler of the band Sirius Bright. You can find it and other Sirius Bright tunes wherever you listen to music. Thanks to my producer and friend, Matt Haas Queen, for his tireless efforts to keep me on point. I appreciate you, my brother. And to you, the listeners. Without you, it would just be the community in my head, truly talking nonstop. Don't forget to drop us a note at our Facebook page, The Recovering Artist Podcast. We'd love to hear from you. See you soon, my friends, and remember, let go of the puzzles you can't solve. Only step by step, stage by stage, can you travel the road to greater knowledge and understanding. Have a great day.
Scream out, but I don't make a sound. What do you think? What do you think? What do you think about me? in your ward, even when you are gone. What the hell have we done wrong? We're still here fighting your war, even when you are gone. What the hell have we done wrong? We're still here fighting your war, even when you are gone. What the hell have we done wrong? We're still here fighting your war, even when you are gone. What the hell have we done?
Bye.